This is a lecture given at St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas. Visit our website, stdave.org.
Over the last, 6 or 8 months, I've had had a problem at my house, which is that my house has been invaded by brain mold, and I can't seem to like permanently get rid of brain mold. So I've thrown away what seems to be like thousands of dollars of spices and like all of my flour and pasta and bean marinator has come twice, and I have taken a closet full of moth-infested clothes to cleaners, and I think that I've like gotten rid of them all. I think I've licked the problem. And then it turns out that they are just lying in wait. And like a month later, these brain moths reappear. Mm-hmm. And when I consider them abstractly, they're not all that unpleasant. So the other week I was watching one flap around the bookcase. It was small and translucent, and it occurred to me that the translucence of the moth wing did not look entirely different from Eucharistic wafer. But nonetheless, I have grown to hate these moths. And I am unable to extend to them a kind of dispassionate philosophical thought like, these moths were created by God, they're not really doing me any harm. I actually wish the whole living species would become extinct. So, this is relevant to Psalm 91. On the third page of your handout. Starting at the third verse, he will deliver you from the snare of the fowler and from the deadly pestilence. He will cover you with his pinions, and under his wings you will find refuge. So I'm going to argue that our psalmist here is likening God to a moth. Admittedly, the psalmist does not use the word moth. The psalmist instead speaks of God's pinions, and I admit that I didn't know what a pinion was. Would anyone else like to admit that they don't know what a pinion is? Thank you. So I looked it up in the Oxford English Dictionary, and it turns out that the word pinion can refer to a bird's wing, specifically the part of the bird's wing that bears the primary flight feathers, or, said the OED, the word pinion can refer to the wing of the moth. So, one reading of our psalm is to say that God is here being likened to a bird, to a goldfinch, or a brown thrasher, or a yellow-breasted chap perching on the telephone wire or hiding in the shrubs near a stream. But another reading of the psalm is to say that God is being likened to a brain moth, covering us with his pinions. Now, I've gotten pretty brutal with my brain moths in the last few months. I can really, without giving it a second thought, just slap them between my hands and kill them. So it is one thing to imagine sheltering under the avian wing of God, who is an eagle or something, and it is quite another to think of God as a pantry moth. And as I've been pondering this psalm in concert with my own moth problem, I have found myself wondering just how often I have experienced God as a pest, wishing that God would leave my house and leave me alone. So I give you this psalm not because I want to dwell in any more detail on God as a grain moth, but because this is one of the texts of the Bible, and I could have chosen some other ones, but this is one of them that crams multiple metaphors for God just sort of on top of one another, like layers on a cake. And so take a moment and cast your eye over these verses from Psalm 91. This psalm is really sort of bursting with metaphorical descriptions of God. There's this wing imagery, the idea that God is a winged thing, a bird or a moth. There's also militaristic imagery in this psalm. So in that same verse, verse 4, God is, or God's faithfulness is a shield. And this shield image, like the wing image, is primarily an image of protection, of course. But it's not only an image of protection. And I admit, I think people come to the militaristic imagery for God with very different associations. And probably in this room, we have a lot of different associations with that militaristic imagery. I confess that it's not imagery I'm particularly comfortable with or interested in. It's been sort of, I find it fun and delightful to think about clothing. I've had to really sort of press myself to really sit with the large amount of militaristic imagery for God and the bad God of the Bible. And shield, I think, is a really interesting piece of that militaristic imagery. So, again, obviously, when the scriptures speak of God as shielding us or as having a shield and shielding us, say, with God's faithfulness, that's primarily an image of protection. It's not only protection. Shields are also heavy. So if you had a shield in ancient Rome, it would have weighed about 35 pounds. A former student of mine who served in Afghanistan did some work on this image with me, and he told me that in Afghanistan he wore body armor, sort of a modern-day shield, right? And his body armor weighed about 75 pounds. And he said that it really became, in a sense, like a second skin for him. So this, too, is in a way like an image of intimacy. But he also just underscored, when talking to me about this image, how heavy the stuff was, the body armor, the shield was. And to this day, Ryan gets steroid shots in his shoulder because of lasting effects of carrying his body armor, carrying his shield. And indeed, there are a number of studies that suggest that there's a connection between the weight of contemporary body armor, modern-day shields on the one hand, and the fairly staggering amount of musculoskeletal damage that doctors are seeing people coming back from Afghanistan with. So when we name God as a shield, as we often do in the Psalms of the Bible, that's an opportunity to think about how God protects us, but it also maybe is an opportunity to think about how we sometimes struggle under the heaviness of that protection. This psalm also imagines God in verse 9 as a dwelling place, a habitation, so our home. The Most High, the Lord, is our home, which is an interesting image. And in that same verse, refuge, I was thinking of that like 2 days ago when I was hearing about the polar vortex and thinking about, like, the NPR was talking about how there were, like, hot spaces, heat refuges being opened up in Wisconsin and Indiana in the middle of this polar vortex. They're a refuge, a dwelling place. But of all of the many images in this psalm, the one that captures my imagination the most is in the first verse. You who live in the shelter of the Most High, who abide in the shadow of the Almighty. And I give you above this psalm on our handout two other lines from the psalm that speak of God as one who casts shadows. All people may take refuge in the shadow of your wing, and guard me in the apple of your eye, hide me in the shadow of your wings. So I really love this shadow language, and the depiction of God as one who casts shadows. And I think that I probably wouldn't have noticed this language if I'd been reading these Psalms in the summer, when the sun is high in the sky and our shadows are short. So I think that I started to notice this in the autumn when our shadows lengthen. I think it's a really intriguing and odd image to say that God casts shadows. Because in our common lexicon and in our culture, we often think of shadows as menacing, right? So in gothic horror movies, you don't ever see the killer, right? You just see his shadow fall across the floor and then a heron screams and all that's wrong. But in the scriptures, shadows are almost never sinister. As in this psalm, in all three of these psalms that have these shadow verses, biblical shadows are usually a sign of refuge. And one of my other favorite shadow places, other than the Psalter, is the book of Acts, right? So the book of Acts is that book that we get after the Gospels that charts the disciples going out into the world, and they're trying to figure out how to be the church after Jesus ascended. And the book of Acts makes a really remarkable mention of shadows in its fifth chapter. So men and women have begun to realize that just as Jesus could heal people, so too his disciples could somehow heal in the name of Jesus. And so in Acts 5, we get this moment where Peter is about to come to town, and so the people bring their sick and their lame, and they line them up in beds and on mats in the street because they knew that Peter was going to pass through, and they thought that people would be healed if only his shadow fell on them. So this, I think, gorgeous idea that Jesus has given us so much power and so much love that even our shadow falling on someone could be an agent of God's healing. So on the simplest level, to say that God casts a shadow is simply to say that God is embodied, that God is thinged, because you can't cast a shadow if you don't have substance. So for us to speak of God as one who casts shadows is maybe always to look forward to Christmas, when God comes among us embodied and literally shadow casting. I was walking through there's a two blocks from my house, there's a school and a park, and I was walking through the park a couple weeks ago, and I saw a little girl playing. And at first, I couldn't figure out what she was playing with. There were no other kids, and she didn't seem to have any toys. And then I realized she was playing with her shadow. Now, I don't know if you remember the first time you discovered your shadow as a kid, and how much you played with your shadow, and maybe I've exaggerated in my own memory, but I remember spending what seemed like hours, making my shadow get tall and short, and making my shadow wave and leap. Shadows are, of course, great toys because kids don't have to share them. And you can't accidentally leave yours at the park. So I wonder if to speak of God casting shadows is to speak of God in a childlike way, or to speak of God's inner child, if you like that terminology. I wonder if God likes to play with God's shadow, if God draws God's shadow with chalk or has a tea party with God's shadow. I wonder if when we speak, as we do so often in the Psalms, of sheltering in God's shadow, we are actually speaking of sheltering in God's play. And I think it invites a different way of thinking about what it means to be protected by and sheltered by God, to think not only are we being somehow protected and sheltered by God's strength, and which might be held in those military images, but somehow when we are sheltering in God, we are sheltering in God's play. So this is just, again, one of the passages of Scripture that we could have looked at that is really overflowing with images. We could also have looked at the Song of Moses, which comes late in Deuteronomy and stacks up like six images of God, one on top of the other. And the Song of Moses is instructive because it's one of the very few Old Testament passages that refers to God as Father. That's primarily New Testament language, and even more specifically, it's primarily language from the Gospel of John. So somehow in the church, we've taken this language that primarily lives in one gospel and made that like really, really central in our prayer lives and our imagination lives. But the Song of Moses, late in Deuteronomy, is one of the few passages that refers to God as Father. But then, like two or three verses later, it refers to God as a pregnant rock. So it's a wonderful juxtaposition of images. It begins to suggest that Scripture doesn't contain all of these many images of God by accident, that actually the very multiplicity of so many images, the very abundance of the images, helps us remember that no one of these images is ever going to get at all of who God is. And that none of the images are to be taken literally, right? You can't have Father and pregnant rock right alongside each other. And what is a pregnant rock anyway? Maybe I'm not enough. I don't know enough about rock. So Chuck said to me at dinner, he said, I think it's so great if you just went deep into one image for the whole hour. That's not what we're doing for our current hour. Sorry, Chuck. Now we're just going to give you this sort of overview. So we've looked at this basket of imagery in Psalm 91. Uh-huh. And I want to look at two more baskets of imagery, and then hopefully we'll have about 10 or 15 minutes for some questions. So I want to look at imagery pertaining to sensory perception. So one of the things that the writers of Scripture are surprisingly interested in is evoking or specifying taste, sight, sound. And I find it surprising because there are a whole lot of kind of details that the scriptural writers don't seem to be very interested in. They don't explicitly evoke the psychological or emotional landscape of the characters they're writing about very often. They never tell us what Jesus looked like. And there are all kinds of things we might want to know that the scriptural writers seem to think these are peripheral details. But a lot of the biblical writers are really interested in getting at sensory perception. And when you're reading the Bible, or when you're listening to the Bible in church on Sunday, you can listen for details of hearing, sight, taste, touch, smell. And as you listen for those, contemplate the possibility, this isn't always true, but it's very often true, that when the biblical writers use a sensory detail, they're actually trying to do two levels of work. So on the one hand, sensory perception simply means that someone got some information, right? I see you, so I know that you're there. Or I hear you, so I know that you're communicating something to me. But in addition to just communicating information, sensory perception in the Bible usually has some kind of additional symbolic meaning. For example, sight. When you see the language of sight, either a person in the Bible being described as seeing or God being described as seeing, usually that means not only did the person or God get some information through their eyeballs, but also the person entailed an obligation to respond to the information they received. So the kind of knowledge that sight is for the biblical writers is a kind of knowledge that means that you are obligated to respond to what you've learned through sight. For example, like in the Joseph story, Joseph's brothers are starving. Joseph has stored up a bunch of wheat in Egypt. It is only when Joseph sees his brothers that he realizes he has an obligation to help them survive the famine. Or God in the burning bush says to Moses, I heard and saw the sufferings of my children Israel in bondage and slavery, and I realized upon hearing and seeing their sufferings that I had to come down here and do something about it. So sensory perception often has sort of double layers of meaning. What I'd like to talk about for a few minutes is not the more common and familiar senses of sight and hearing. I'd like to talk for a few minutes about smell. The God of the Bible is depicted as smelling in both senses of the term, both perceiving scent and omitting an odor. Primarily, the former. Primarily, God is described as perceiving scent. But there's one key place where God is described as emitting a smell, and it's in the book of Ephesians. I don't know what offertory sentences your priests are fond of, but often in the Episcopal Church, at that moment where the offerings are brought forward to the altar, the priest says a sentence, and although the priest can say really any sentence he or she wants, often we say, walk in love as Christ loved us and gave himself an offering and sacrifice. For my nods, is that what you're saying?
Fragrant offering.
Say that again?
Fragrant.
Oh, you say that?
Yes.
That's really rare. Okay.
It's in the Bible.
It is in the Bible. That's exactly my point. So, this is very surprising. Most Episcopal churches leave out the fragrant part. In most Episcopal churches, and I have like researched this and asked the church historians, and no one can tell me why this is, they leave out the word fragrant, or sometimes the translation goes, an offering and a sacrifice to God for a sweet-smelling savor. And it's so interesting that you say fragrant, because most of the school priests don't. And I started trying it out at church, tacking on the sweet-smelling savor part. I couldn't tell that anyone in my congregation noticed, but I'm saying it. Okay, so this is interesting. So here we are in Ephesians. You all are already tutored on the olfactory sense. So Jesus is giving himself a sacrifice to the Father, a fragrant sacrifice, or a sacrifice with a sweet-smelling savor. So, the sacrifice smells good to God the Father. Well, that's weird. Like, what does that mean? Could that be literally true? What's going on? So here's God and Jesus emitting a scent, and it smells good to God the Father. The early church picked up that verse and started giving Jesus all kinds of nicknames like treasury of perfume or fragrance of lily. These were like nicknames that various early church fathers gave Jesus. So the verse, to my mind, doesn't make any sense unless you look back to the Old Testament to look at the passages where God is described not as giving off an odor, but as receiving an odor. So the biblical authors of the Old Testament, especially, are super interested in God as one who perceives scent. And some 40 or so times in the Old Testament, you get this two-word Hebrew phrase that is usually translated as soothing scent or soothing smell. You first get it in the book of Genesis when Noah, we're in the flood story, the flood has happened, the flood has receded, the ark is safe, everyone is safe, everyone on the, well, not everyone, everyone who's on the ark is safe, and Noah makes an offering of animals, and the offering is described as giving off a soothing scent to God, and God accepts the sacrifice. That's the first mention. Then there are again like 40 or so other mentions. But usually, after the Noah story, when we read about God getting a sacrifice that has a soothing scent, the sacrifice is an incense offering. It's not a burnt animal. It's incense. And this happens a lot in Leviticus, for example. Has anyone tried to read the Bible straight through, like starting in Genesis? Did anyone not make it? And one of the places people sometimes bog down is Leviticus. I think Leviticus is actually super interesting. I think the laws that are described in Leviticus are fascinating, and I like to think of them I like to ask myself when I'm reading Old Testament laws, what is the reputation that a community that observes these laws, what reputation would they have among their neighbors? And as Christians, we are not going to suddenly start observing the finer points of Levitical law, but we might ask ourselves, like, the ancient Israelites who observed the dietary codes, right? Maybe if you observe those dietary codes, you have a reputation as a community that understands something about appetite and understands something about the joys of appetite and the restraint of appetite, right? Or if you're a community that has the particular hospitality codes embodied in Old Testament law, you might have a reputation for, like, risky and extravagant hospitality to strangers. So I like to ask, what kind of reputation would you have if you observe these laws, and what might Christians do to cultivate a similar kind of reputation? So I actually quite like the videos, but I admit that I struggle when reading the lengthy descriptions of the sacrificial system. And I struggle when reading the descriptions of the sacrificial system because it is so foreign from my own way of connecting to God. Like, the way that I connect with God is primarily verbal. I say things to God or sitting in silence with God. But the idea of, like, offering God my fruits, my persimmons from my persimmon tree, and that sacrifice or offering is connecting to God, I just have a hard time getting my head around how that is a way of intimacy with God. Until I come to these descriptions of the incense offering and God perceiving a soothing scent and accepting the sacrifice. There is a scholar at the University of Oregon named Deborah Green, and she has written an entire book about smell in the Old Testament and in rabbinic literature. And she says this incense, all of these incense offerings, were like a kind of divine aromatherapy. And what they did, she said, was calm God's mood, calm God's anger, and in calming God, the incense made God available for a particular moment of intimacy with the people of Israel. So I read that, and I begin to understand, because I have the experience of having my mood affected by a soothing scent, right? I'm a chronic insomniac. I often, like, spray lavender spray on my pillowcase because it soothes me and calms me down. So I can relate to God being soothed by this incense. Deborah Green also notes that all of the other sacrifices in the Old Testament, the turtle doves, the first fruits, and etc., they all have specific purposes. Their job is to rectify impurity, for example, or to help the people prepare for a moment of divine revelation. But she notes that the incense offerings have no purpose. They simply give this soothing scent to God, and God is pleased, calmed, and God accepts the sacrifice. And when I read this book by her, I realized that I, like, sort of known semi-consciously, but hadn't known that I had known, that the biblical Hebrew phrase that is used when either God or people are described as being really angry literally means to flare your nostrils, to scrunch your nose. And that makes a certain kind of sense, because, like, I can only flare my nostrils when I'm annoyed, or, like, a horse might flare its nostrils when it's angry. And similarly, the Hebrew phrase for when people are being described as, like, calming down, erech apayim, literally means they have long faces. Their nose has gotten unscrunched as they leave the space of anger and enter a space of calm. So I think there's actually something to this idea that God's mood is calmed and God's anger is appeased by smelling this incense. So I want to suggest further that we can imaginatively, that's all kind of rooted in the Hebrew, I think we can imaginatively extrapolate some other things about God's emotional life from all of this language about smell in the Old Testament. Contemporary neuroscience tells us that our emotional processing, the emotional processing of our brain, is more intimately linked to smell, to olfaction, than it is to any other mode of sensory perception. So, you can see something, you can hear something, and you can have a very quick emotional response. You can hear the song that you danced with your spouse on your first date 73 years ago, and you can have an immediate emotional response to it. But smell will actually produce an even more immediate emotional response. So our smell processing, our olfactory processing, is very intimately linked to our emotional processing. And social scientists and psychologists have found that one of the specific pieces of emotional work that smell does for us is what some psychologists call olfactory comfort. Olfactory comfort. So olfactory comfort is the kind of comfort that scent or smell can produce when you are distressed by the absence of a loved one. It's a very particular circumstance and kind of comfort. So, olfactory comfort is why, when your beloved has gone on a long trip, you might sleep in his shirt, because the smell calms you in your distress and his absence. Olfactory comfort is why there was a nurse in Minnesota who patented like a half shirt, half baby blanket. And the job of this shirt, baby blanket, was if a new mother knew she was gonna leave the house in a couple of hours and hand the baby off to a babysitter, she was to put on this garment. It would absorb her smell, and then when she was ready to go to work or go out on a date or whatever what she was doing, she would wrap baby in this garment, and the baby would be less distraught by her leaving because of this property of olfactory comfort. So I love the idea that perhaps the specific emotional work that the incense offerings and even Christ's offering on the cross, the specific work that is doing for God is not just like a generic divine aromatherapy, but actually it's an indicator to us that God is actually very deeply grieved by our absence. And the specific soothing work that this sweet-smelling savor or fragrant offering can do is comfort God in the face of our absence. I want to go to two more texts pertaining to smell, then we'll look at one final image. This idea that smell helps connect us to people in absence shows up, I think, in a couple of places in the Bible. One that I want to take us to comes from the letter that Paul wrote to the Philippians. So the Philippians Paul writes to the Philippians from jail. Paul is in some unidentified imperial city. He's been arrested on unstated charges. He is sitting in jail. The people that he had gotten to know in Philippi had sent him a visitor named Epaphroditus and had sent him a gift, probably money. And it's interesting to note that Paul often writes letters to churches that he cares about but doesn't seem to like very much. So like when he writes to the Corinthians, it's clear that he wants the Corinthians to thrive as Christians and as a new church. It's also clear that he finds them to be like fractious and annoying, and he doesn't really seem to miss being with them. But the Philippians, he seems to really like. These people actually seem to be his friends, and he seems actually to miss them. He'd gone through some intense experiences with them in Philippi. There'd been like a divine jailbreak, and he was deeply bonded to the Philippians. And he really seems, in this letter to them, to miss them. So the letter to Philippians is not very long. It's like four chapters long, and he talks about prayer and self-presumption and piety and all sorts of theological things. And then at the very end of the letter, he gets around to thanking them for sending him Epaphroditus and for sending him this gift, which was probably money. Now, scholars have noted that the language that Paul uses to thank the Philippians for their gift is like tortured and awkward. He seems to be really uncomfortable thanking them. Scholars have used the words detached, distant, and discourteous to describe how Paul thanks the Philippians for their gift. So to put this another way, like my mother elevated the thank you note to a literary art form, and Paul would not have measured up to her standards. So first of all, he fails to specify what the gift is. This is a no-no in thank you note. My nephew used to send me thank you notes that said, "Dear Aunt Lauren, thank you for it." Except my nephew at least directly said thank you. Paul doesn't really ever directly say thank you. Then he goes on to insist that he doesn't really need the gift. And it's not in the sense of like, thank you for sending me, you know, this vase that I don't, you know, I never knew I needed it, but I just love it, and it's so delightful to have something that isn't utilitarian. I just love it. It's more like in the sense of thank you, although, as I've tried to tell you every Christmas for the last 19 years, I really don't need another Santa-shaped soup tureen, right? So he insists that he doesn't need the gift. And then he says that the gift isn't really for him, it's for God. And this would be like my grandmother, blessed memory, used to send me money in college, you know, and she wanted me to spend it on something fun. It would be as though I wrote to her and said, like, thank you, I've given this check that you sent me to UNICEF. So this is like awkward thank you note at the end of the letter. But then Paul writes, I have received from Epaphroditus the gift you sent, a fragrant offering, a sacrifice acceptable and pleasing to God. So, okay, he's saying he's giving it to UNICEF, but sacrifice to God. But he uses this same fragrant language that we see in Ephesians and in your offertory sentence. Jesus is a fragrant offering, and Paul is connecting this gift of money to Christ's gift on the cross. But I think it's also really significant that in the one letter we get where Paul seems to miss people, he uses this smell language. So he's not just saying thank you for the gift. He's also saying, I'm sitting here in prison. I would really rather be with you. But your gift actually makes me feel reconnected to you. So I'm going to use this language of olfactory comfort, this scent and sense that can comfort me as I am far away from you. I mentioned earlier that I teach in the women's prison in Raleigh, and teaching in that prison has really made me read Paul's letters from prison quite differently. And particularly this gift that the church in Philippi gives Paul. I have a friend who, she's no longer in prison, but she was in prison for a couple of years, and she was a lifelong member of the Baptist Church in Garner, North Carolina. And every week, a lady from the church would send her the church bulletin, and it made her feel so connected to her church community. And the lady took notes on the sermon, and like there was a prayer list, and she would write like, this is why we're praying for so-and-so, this is why we're praying for so-and-so. She also noted who wasn't in church that week. So I think of those church bulletins now when I read about the Philippians gift. The final smell passage I want to take us to, it's really two passages, both making the same point. In the Psalms, and it's in a version of the Psalms that we quoted in the evening prayer order in the Book of Common Prayer, the psalmist asks God to receive his prayers, like incense being offered. And then that same image is picked up in Revelation, where the prayers of the saints are described as incense carried in golden bowls. And it is that image of our prayer as incense that to me is where the sort of metaphorical payoff of all this smell stuff is. If it is the case that God in the Old Testament is depicted as being soothed by the smell of incense because God is grieved by the ways that the people of Israel have left or far away from God, and if Jesus on the cross picks up that imagery in Ephesians, so that God, part of the work that the cross is doing is that again is reconnecting us to God, though we have been absent from God, and there is something olfactorily comforting about the cross to God, and then our prayers get connected with that. So that when you pray, your prayers are not just like abstractly received by God, who wants to check off on a list that you have prayed that week. Rather, God is receiving your prayers, among other things, as olfactory comfort because God is grieved by our absence. And it is our prayer. We are the golden bowls, and the church is the golden bowl, and our prayers are rising as a soothing incense that comforts God as God is grieved by our absence. So, that is the sense of smell. And I want to look at one final image before we take a few minutes for questions and then break. So far tonight, we've mostly looked at imagery that I think it's safe to say is not imagery we pay a whole lot of attention to in the church. I have not heard many sermons about Christ the cardigan sweater or God as one who smells. But paying attention to metaphors and sort of having this spirit of playful, associational ruminating on these metaphors can also open up new meanings to some of the metaphors for God that are really familiar to us. So in my life, one of the images that has been made more meaningful is the image of God as a shepherd. Right, this is one of those ones that we just talk about all the time. There are churches named the Church of the Good Shepherd. We have Good Shepherd Sunday in the Episcopal Church, where Sunday schoolers all over the country use cotton balls and pipe cleaners and toilet roll tubes to somehow enact sheep and et cetera, et cetera. Many of us are in churches that have a stained glass window, the Good Shepherd window, Jesus, broad-shouldered, brawny, with a sheep in his arm. And of course, Jesus claims this image in the Gospel of John, saying, "I am the good shepherd." And when Jesus says, "I'm the good shepherd," Jesus is identifying with a zillion Old Testament references in the Psalms and the Prophets, where God is described as the shepherd of Israel, "the Lord is my shepherd," being perhaps the most famous. Well, I have to admit that this is not an image that I immediately connect to. Right, I don't know anything about shepherding. I don't know any shepherds. That's not true. I know one shepherd. I will digress for a moment to tell you about the one shepherd I know. 5 years ago, when I was just about to start my job as a very part-time priest at St. Paul's Episcopal in Lewisburg, North Carolina, I flew out to Seattle to give some talks at a church. And I was starting my job at the church, like at my church, a week later, and I was completely terrified that I was not going to be able to do a good job as the priest of this little parish. I'd been ordained for about 2 years, but I hadn't really served in the church, and I felt that it was a huge responsibility, and I didn't really know what I was doing, and that I was going to fail, and it was going to be a disaster. So the woman who picked me up from the church in Seattle at the airport, driving me into town, as we drove into town, she told me about the three pastors on staff at the church. And Pastor X was all into like leading the church's social justice ministries, and Pastor Y was super into like education, and Pastor Catherine was a shepherd. And I said, You know, it's so helpful for me to hear you say that, because if in like 5 years someone from my congregation is saying Vicar Lauren is our shepherd, then I will feel like I actually learned how to be their priest, and I will feel like I have done a good job. And then it's, no, Pastor Catherine really is a shepherd. And I said, yes, exactly. If that's what you're saying about me, different line is really a shepherd. So I said, no, Pastor Catherine lives on an island off the coast of Seattle on a sheep farm. She gets up every morning, tends her sheep, hops on her motorcycle, I'm not making this up, motorcycles into the ferry, and then comes in to do her day job at the church. So I've now met Pastor Catherine twice, and when I come to that line where Jesus says, I am the good shepherd, I now picture Pastor Catherine on her motorcycle. But the other image, other than Pastor Catherine, that really cracked open Jesus as the good shepherd for me, and God of the shepherd's job, is this picture. So this ran in the Guardian newspaper a few years ago, maybe 7 or 8 years ago. They did a series of photographs called Shepherds Around the World. And most of them were like them. And then there was this picture. This is in Abbottabad, Pakistan. That's where the Bin Laden compound was. So here's this little girl. We haven't killed her with a drone. She's a young woman by now. And here she is leading this flock. And I looked at this picture, and I totally fell in love with it and her. But I was also deeply confused because, like, girls are not shepherds. When was the last time you saw a Christmas card with girl shepherds, you know, or, like, in the church pattern? But I started doing a little research, which you by now are figuring out I'd like to do, and I learned that actually in lots of parts of the world, shepherding is work given to girls. In Bedouin communities, in some parts of Bolivia, shepherding is girls' work. And then I realized that I, of course, had already known that, because we talk, even in the history of the church, about shepherdesses. It's just that the word shepherdess makes me think they're not shepherds somehow. So Joan of Arc was a shepherdess before she became Joan of Arc. And then that song, do you all sing that horrible song on All Saints Day? I want to be one too. Yes. The saints of God. So that's the one that like lists all the saints and then says there's no reason I can't be a saint. But it's many of them, but one of them is a shepherdess on the green.
Yes.
Right, so I read, okay, I should have known there were girl shepherds because of the shepherdess on the green when they know I'm All Saints Day song. And then I realized there are girl shepherds in the Bible. So Rachel, in Genesis, does shepherding work. And then in Exodus 2, there's a really interesting story where Moses, let me back up, there's a priest of Midian, and he has 7 daughters. And he also has some sheep. And the 7 daughters are shepherding his sheep, and they go to a watering hole with these sheep. And some male shepherds try to run them out of the watering hole. And Moses comes and intervenes and helps the young women finish their shepherding, and then goes back to the priest of Midian, who is their father, and he winds up marrying one of them, Zipporah. So I don't think I would have seen this story this way until like our current cultural moment, but I actually think in all seriousness that this is the Bible's first description of workplace sexual harassment. Like, these female shepherds are being driven out of their workplace by these male shepherds who do not want them there. And what all of this says to me is that when Jesus identifies as the good shepherd, it is an act of identification. It's not only the broad-shouldered, brawny Jesus. He's identifying with her. And he's identifying with those girl shepherds in Exodus 2. He's also identifying with all of the male shepherds in the Bible and And he is also identifying with the strong. But probably even for men, shepherding is vulnerable work, right? But there's a particular, the Exodus 2 story shows us, there's maybe a particular kind of vulnerability and risk for young female shepherds. And that when Jesus says, "I am the good shepherd," he's also talking about Zipporah and this girl. So that's just a small example of how sitting with even a very familiar image of God from the Bible can actually crack open some new meanings and some new avenues that you might walk with that image. So we have about 7 minutes, I think, and I would like to take any questions, and then I'll be back tomorrow for further conversation. Yes, sir.
Does the devil wear a Prada?
What? Who?
Does the devil wear a Prada?
Does the devil wear a Prada? I have not read that book or seen the movie. I'll say yes. Any other questions?
I was thinking in context, there was a story in the Times today about Roger Stone and his wardrobe, his fabulous wardrobe, and how he uses this as a weapon.
Interesting.
People doing. So I was wondering, are there instances you go across in either Testament of clothing or absence of clothing or skin being used in ways other than what the benevolent ways used?
Interesting. So where in the scriptures is clothing weaponized? The way that clothing and stripping functions in the crucifixion story. This is another thing that I've seen a little differently happen since I started teaching in the women's prison. The various ways that in the crucifixion story things happen to Jesus that mark him as one who is being criminalized. And I just never really thought about the stripping of Jesus. And you know, we do on Holy Thursday the stripping of the altar. I had this like highly metaphorical thought about that. Until I started talking to my students at the women's prison who, you know, are strip searched when they come in. And it's a big part of how they, in their own minds, become people who are part of the criminal justice system. So I think that's a use of clothing that is complex and not only benevolent. I'm sure there are other examples. Chuck, do you have any other examples of clothing as non-benevolent in the scriptures off the top of your head?
Jacob and Esau.
Oh, yeah, Jacob and Esau. Mm-hmm. Or the coat of many colors. So see, back to the idea of the Lenten Bible study about clothing. Can you all through all of this? Great question. Any other questions you want to get on the table? Yes, sir.
Going off of your last comments about Jesus as the shepherd and the way it's masculinized and feminized, what are your thoughts or what have you found like looking at androgynous imagery in the Bible, because I'm thinking about Christ especially in the way there are different ways of figuring Christ that are masculinized and feminized, and then how there are all these erotic traditions in the church of like devotional imagery of Christ, and if things you might have found.
Yeah, that's a great question. So the question is about androgynous imagery or gendering in unexpected ways. So I guess I would say two things about that. One is that I am constantly surprised by my own assumptions that certain images just are male. So for example, the image from the prophets of God the Potter, I just, in a non-reflective way, always kind of like semi-took, like that unless an image is marked as female in some like hitting you over the head way, I, because we say he all the time, like subliminally assume that all other images must kind of default to a male image until I went and hung out with a woman potter. And it's not that the image then became feminine, you know, it made me realize that potter, it could, you know, could be anything, could be anyone. And so in my own life with this work, I think I'm still at a pretty early stage of just noticing how many images I assume I default to them being a masculine image. And then if we really want to get like crazy gender theory, do you? I don't know if you do. I think that there are even images in the scriptures that seem to strongly be marked as male or female that I might want to say on closer inspection aren't necessarily. I'll just give one example. Have a friend in North Carolina who's a priest, who's a woman, she identifies as a woman, whose preferred priest title is father. She is Father Kathy. And her explanation of this is that when we call the first person of the Trinity Father, we are not saying the first person of the Trinity is a man. And that's Christian Orthodoxy. It is Christian Orthodoxy that we are not saying the first person of the Trinity is male by using father language. So what is father language in the Bible, or mother language? Like, are these getting at traits, behaviors? This is a much longer conversation. I think it's a great question, and I'm going to stop before I take more rope and hang myself. Maybe one more question? Yes.
In the sheltering... the psalm. Do you think the psalmist is over-promising? Because he says, no evil shall befall you, no scourge. He will guard you in all your ways, so that it's like 100% guarantee that you're going to be protected. And you know that in real life, 100% is not always.
So that is a very significant question. I will answer it in a sideways way, or not going to answer, I'll respond to it in a sideways way. Last Sunday, I think, the gospel was Jesus quoting Isaiah. Right, this was last Sunday. So Jesus goes into the synagogue and reads Isaiah. Isaiah says, I've come to give sight to the blind, heal the sick. And then Jesus says, all of this is now fulfilled. So it's a similar kind of thing, right? What does that mean? I mean, obviously, in some way, it isn't true. I mean, in a straightforward way, we are not always protected. So I think that this language... I think there's complexity, and I'm not trying to undermine the complexity or smooth that all over. But I didn't preach last week, I found myself sitting in church hearing those words and thinking, Jesus is at the right hand of the Father and can see more from up there than I can see. So this is a statement that's bigger. This is a statement that reflects a wider perspective than I have. I know that my perspective gets distorted. I try to back up my car, and I think I don't have enough room to do it, and actually I have ample room, right? So similarly, I think these promises of the psalmist, I want to assert, they are true. The psalms don't lie to us, so how can they be true? They can only be true. I think, these kind of statements, these protection statements, as an eschatological statement of what will seem obvious when God has finished healing the cosmos of all of its damage. But this sure does not seem obvious now. I will make a book recommendation as I close. I just finished reading this wonderful novel that came out a couple years ago called The Anchoress. Did anyone read this? It's a great novel about a medieval woman who was enclosed in an anchor. So in the medieval era, a very small number of women didn't just become nuns, but they actually vowed themselves to live in a sealed cell that was attached to a church, and they wouldn't leave the cell. Julian of Norwich was an anchoress. And this is a novel about an anchoress that's super good. But one of the tropes is the confessor saying to the anchoress, don't go to God thinking that what you're going to get is safety. Which is a troubling and profound and somehow deeply true statement, and somehow Psalm 91 is also true. On that note, if we have a prayer book, we have a prayer book, we can say, I'm closing the comments. You want to pop up and say a call out from memory?
Here.
Peaceful night, perfect down. Okay, great. I don't really do prayers by heart.
keep
watching. And as I'm finding this prayer, I'll remind you that tomorrow there's church and there is adult, what do you want to call it, adult forum here at some time. And I will be here at whatever time that is.
While you're looking that up, can I give the actual time?
Yes, please do.
It's in Compline, by the way. 9 o'clock in Historic Church, and Lauren will be preaching. 10:15 in here, Lauren will continue this conversation. And 11:15 in Historic Church, Lauren will preach again. She's got a big morning, so come on.
Thank you. The Lord be with you.
And also with you.
Let us pray. Be present, O merciful God, and protect us through the hours of this night, so that we who are wearied by the changes and chances of this life may rest in your eternal changelessness. Keep watch with those who work or watch or weep this night, and give your angels charge over those who sleep. Tend the sick, Lord Christ, give rest to the weary, bless the dying, soothe the suffering, pity the afflicted, shield the joyous, and all for your love's sake. Amen.
Amen.
You can find more lectures and sermons on iTunes by searching for St. David's Episcopal Church in Austin, Texas, or visit our website at saintdave.org and click on the podcast button.